From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Space travel, the past and the future. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 40 years ago today, humans accomplished a goal as old as the species when two men walked on the moon. Today, we'll talk with moonwalker number two, Buzz Aldrin, about the moon itself and the depression and alcoholism he faced on returning to Earth. Aldrin's among those who say the moon itself is a dead end, but that humans could get to Mars before 2050. He insists we should. Others point out we've been there for 5 years with robots, which make more precise observations and never need to come home. On Reporter's Notebook later on, I.F. Stone, the reporter who blogged before blogging had been invented. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. 40 years ago today, Buzz Aldrin became the second man to walk on the moon. Was that the outer limit of human capacity? Should we let robots take it from there? Or should we humans try to reach Mars? We'll talk with Buzz Aldrin and others. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll hear about I.F. Stone, once accused as a Russian spy, later celebrated as Washington's premier investigative journalist. First, this news update. Four soldiers reportedly were killed today in Afghanistan. Over the weekend, various websites received video of PFC Bo Bergdahl. He's the American soldier captured in Afghanistan almost 3 weeks ago. Here's a brief excerpt of Bergdahl talking about his family.
I have a very, very good family that I love back home in America. Mm-hmm. And I miss them every day that I'm gone. I miss them. And I'm afraid that I might never see them again, and that I'll never be able to tell them that I love them again. I'll never be able to hug them.
In Haley, Idaho, his hometown, Sheriff Walt Fenling spoke today on behalf of Bergdahl's family.
We'd like to remind all of you that our sole focus is seeing our beloved son, Bo, safely home.
Laurie Goodson is professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College in Pennsylvania. And, Professor, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Secretary Clinton has said, of course, being critical of the release of the video, it's been described by the Army as a propaganda, but she has said we're doing everything possible to try to find the private first class. What are the prospects?
You fear for the worst in these cases, and you hope for the best. And so the prospects of negotiating a release would generally be good in Afghanistan, but perhaps not in this instance because of the opponents that we're engaged with.
Well, I suppose it depends which the opponents are, does it not? Contrary to what we've seen with the people captured by Al-Qaeda itself, in this situation, Bergdahl seems to be eating food and drinking green tea. He says he's being treated like a guest. He's well dressed. He doesn't appear to be undernourished, very emotionally distraught. But might that say something about the way he's being captured and who captured him?
Well, absolutely, and that's what I was sort of trying to allude to. That there are several major factions that are part of the opposition in Afghanistan that we've been engaged in fighting with, and all of the key ones are Afghan led, and they would follow those customary rules of hospitality under normal circumstances, but I'm not privy to the negotiations and all those details, and so I'm just being careful not to speculate about that which I don't really know anything about.
Understand what you're saying, and all any of us have to go on at the moment, of course, other than those directly involved, are the pictures that we have seen. This is the first time, I take it, that an American soldier has been captured in Afghanistan. Is that surprising, given the number of troops that are there and the number that have been killed?
Maybe in one sense it's surprising in light of what you just cited. In another sense, though, the insurgency or the resistance or whatever term you wish to use has strengthened in the last couple of years. And so in the earlier period of time when we were engaged there, the insurgency didn't really have the capacity maybe to do that, and we have also pushed out more into the countryside. So we're, you know, I think it's just a combination of factors that have led to that.
There's been talk recently of upgrading the situation for prisoners that U.S. and NATO forces have taken in Afghanistan. How important is that? How important is it for allied forces to show that if they're not hospitable, that's probably the wrong term since it's not their country, they're at least treating people well?
Well, I mean, that's a huge bone of contention among many Afghans who live in a non-literate rural society and hear all of these stories about how things are in prison facilities and so forth, and tend to believe the worst. And so you're absolutely correct that whatever can be done to indicate that we're doing our best to be, as you say, sort of hospitable or going directly and properly by the book, is going to resonate better with the Afghans.
All right. Obviously, a lot at stake and a very complicated situation there in Afghanistan. Larry Goodson, again, professor of Middle East Studies at the U.S. Army War College, and many thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
In a moment, space travel, the past, and the future on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. What does a man do for an encore after walking on the moon? That's the question Buzz Aldrin faced after 8 days on Apollo 11, including the first moon landing 40 years ago today. It's one of the subjects addressed in his new book, Magnificent Desolation, The Long Journey Home from the Moon. Buzz Aldrin, thank you very much for being on our program.
Very nice to be talking to you today.
Before we get to the aftermath, what was it like to be one of the first two human beings to set foot on another world?
There is no way you can compare that with any other treat that might come along in your life. Neil and I backed up the first flight to the moon, Apollo 8. That put us in good position with Mike Collins to attempt the first landing, which we did, and we know how that came out. We had communication problems coming around the side of the moon. Then we had computer alarms after we got the landing radar to come in. We were assured that that was okay from Mission Control in Houston. We redesignated the landing site a bit. We thought we were going to be long anyway. And then at 500 feet, Neil wasn't too happy with what he saw the computer was taking us to in this very, very supposedly flat terrain at Tranquility Base. At about 100 feet or so, we got 60 seconds low-level warning light on fuel. We were flying over a crater with boulders to get to the other side. I was getting a little concerned because we weren't descending. At 30 seconds, we were a little below 10 feet, and I thought we had it made at that point. Saw the dust being picked up. We had a shadow in front of us, and we touched down with 15, 20 seconds of fuel left. What is it like to be outside? Well, I think the best description really is the magnificence of two creatures from the planet Earth being put in a machine, rocket-powered, gigantic, and a spacecraft that took three of us to the moon and two of us in another spacecraft, and we landed on the moon. And these creatures walked around. What a magnificent testimony to humanity to be able to do something like that. But the scene that we were looking at was so lifeless, like it hadn't been changed in 100,000 years or so, except maybe adding a little bit more dust gradually as micrometeorites impact the moon. So the word desolation just came to mind, putting those two words together, realizing that up above us was the Earth, and more people were watching us and had probably paid attention to two people in history, and yet we were further away in things we had to do to get back home. It was an awesome, serene sight, and very fortunate to come along at just the right time, be in the right place, be fortunate, lucky, whatever you want to call it. And we carried out things relatively successfully, got back, and it was over, but it wasn't over, because the thing I dreaded most was returning to celebrity status, and that was just beginning.
You had a hard time with that. Magnificent Desolation describes not just the moon, but also what life was like after it.
Well, I wanted to return back to my service. None of the three of us wanted to stay on after Apollo 11 and perhaps take away a flight from somebody else who's been waiting in line to get to the moon, walk on the moon, whatever. My option was to return back to the service, complete my service to retirement, or continue on in evolution and general officer rank. I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy as a better way of easing back after 11 years away from the service, but that wasn't made available to me. Instead, being not trained by test pilot training, it surprised me a little bit when they asked me to be commandant of the test pilot school. It just appeared to me that, that this wasn't what I needed, so I hopped from the frying pan into the fire in being unstructured, retired, not knowing what my goal was. I inherited depression and alcoholism. My mother had committed suicide a year before I went to the moon, and my grandfather, her father, committed suicide before I was born. So I had inherited these tendencies, and wrote a little bit about that and returned to Earth and became the national chairman for mental health. It was talking around the country to different mental health centers. Wasn't exactly what I had in mind for a career, being a fighter pilot, but the escapism, the dissatisfaction continued to gnaw away, and alcoholism set in, and I began to eventually recover from that very slowly in a process that made me change, reach out to other people, help them, and have them help me. And about 8 years of sobriety, 9 years, I met a lovely lady from Laguna Beach, Lois. We got married and have been evolving our life together in a growing fashion, evolving, and she supports me in things that I want to do, and I do things that I wouldn't otherwise do because of what she wants to do.
You're a lucky man. Just describe briefly, beyond saying that it was awesome and serene, what the moon was like.
Well, it was airless. Dark sky, 14 days of daylight, 14 days of darkness, very hot or very cold. Radiation coming from the sun, solar flares, cosmic background radiation, just nothing but gray, a cloak, mantle called regolith, covering everything, shades of gray depending on the different angles of the sun. And I just felt this is not a very good place to set up housekeeping.
Were you scared?
No, we weren't scared. We were anxious to be performing to our very best. We were alert, trying to make sure we did the very best that we possibly could under the kind of, stressful situations, knowing that millions of people are watching what you're doing, and you have one chance in a lifetime to get it right, and we evidently did reasonably well.
I would say so. You indicated that it's not a good place to set up housekeeping, and that, in fact, further moon travel would be a dead end, except as a way of developing new technology. Why, there's no point in trying to set up a colony on the moon, what makes you think we could set up a colony on Mars?
Because it's far more terrestrial, 24 plus a few minutes, hours, seasons, the obvious plentiful ice and water, a thin atmosphere, and if we go there, we have to live off the land anyway, because you just can't keep supplying people that far away. You need more than six or seven or eight people to take full advantage of the resources. So you begin growing a critical number of people that may be 50 or 60 to ensure survivability. If you just go there and come back and then go there and come back, Congress will cancel it, and the whole effort will have been a wasted expenditure.
Why go there in the first place? And what makes you think that humans could survive on Mars? What's the point of trying to survive on Mars?
Because the Russians and the Chinese right now have a planned mission called Phobos Grunt for launch in October of this year. It'll probably be postponed for two years or 26 months. But it is a sample return from the moon of Mars, Phobos. Now, they're not doing that just for the heck of it. The Russians have been trying to get to Phobos for a long time. They have a Project 500 where just recently in the papers about six or seven people were in there for 120 days. They plan to do it for 500 days. Do you think they're doing that just for the fun of it?
But is that why we should do it, just because they're doing it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's why we did it in the 60s and 70s. I don't want to lose the automobile industry to Asia, the flat television sets, chips, computers. Next it'll be automobiles. What do we have right now? Because of the investments we made, we have the aerospace industry supremacy, which is security for the United States.
But what is it? You don't have to be secure from Mars, do you?
I don't understand that.
Well, what do you mean by security? The point is, why Mars? And so well, you can prove you can do it, but what have you got out of it?
What would you suggest? Sitting in low Earth orbit while the Chinese and the rest of them go to the moon? Set up permanence, Russia and others go to Mars? Is that the kind of leadership you want this president to embark on? Not me.
You're going to meet with the president soon.
You're right.
What are you going to tell him?
Well, I'm going to soften my words maybe a little bit. I think if he doesn't know already what my intent is, I'll give him a couple of very concise phrases. I'll talk to the National Security Council people, continue to talk to those people. I'll talk to the Secretary of State. Why do we not make the 24 Americans that reached the moon in the 60s and 70s, why don't we make them honorable lunar ambassadors, impress the rest of the world that we did make those sacrifices, and we intend to have Phobos ambassadors and Martian ambassadors. In my estimation, if we send people there and they stay for 5 years, turn around and come back, this to the surface of Mars, they're going to continually be worrying about, when do I get home? When do I get home? Do you think the pilgrims on the Mayflower waited around on Plymouth Rock for the return trip? No, they came here to settle and to face the difficulties that they had, and they made our country what it is today. I think it's that kind of spirit that we need, and the leader of a group of people here on the surface of the earth that establishes a pathway. Now, the earth leader that does that, and it results in creatures from the earth beginning settlement on another planet in the solar system, Mars, that leader is going to go down in history greater than Isabella and greater than Columbus. Don't you think?
Buzz Aldrin, many thanks.
Thank you, Warren.
Once again, Buzz Aldrin followed Neil Armstrong out onto the moon surface 40 years ago today. Jonathan McDowell is an astronomer at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He's also a historian of the space program and writes about it in Jonathan's Space Report. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
We'll talk in a moment about Mars colonization. We have to take a break in just a couple of minutes. I have to ask you a couple of things, though. Have all the astronauts been as blasé as Buzz Aldrin when asked if they were scared? What did the monitors on their bodies show?
Well, you know, it's quite remarkable. I mean, these folks in that generation of astronauts were all test pilots. They were used to risking their lives in high-performance machines. And, you know, when John Young was on the first shuttle flight, his heart rate was so low, he sort of laughed it off by saying, yeah, he was too old now for his heart to run any faster. So it's a tradition that you show the right stuff.
When he talks about coming around the moon, as he put it, and having all kinds of alerts and computer alarms going off and landing with 15 to 20 seconds left of fuel, how close was this to disaster?
Oh, it was a very risky enterprise, yeah, and that's absolutely right. If they hadn't had Neil and Buzz on board, if there'd been people less skilled, they could easily have lost the mission. They were coming down in a bad place to land. They were very short on fuel. So all of that training and skill really, really paid off, and I think people who were watching it at the time didn't really appreciate what a close shave it was.
Did they have much time to look around? He reports, of course, that it was bleak, but doesn't have a lot of detail.
Right. Well, they didn't go very far from the lunar module in that first expedition. You know, they went out for a few hours. They set up some experiments. They put up the American flag, and then they hopped back in and made it for home. On some of the later missions, they stayed on the lunar surface for 4 or 5 days. They made three or four long 8-hour excursions in a little jeep, and so the later astronauts got a much better sense of what it was like to live and work on the moon.
Jonathan McDowell again at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. We'll be back in a moment and have this conversation at greater length a little later on Reporter's Notebook. I.F. Stone, who blogged before there was an internet. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. You just heard Buzz Aldrin, the first second man to set foot on the moon, describe that landing, which we've just heard described as a very risky matter. Without the skill of him and Neil Armstrong, something that might have ended up very differently than it did. Jonathan McDowell, back to you again, a historian of the space program and something that you write about on Jonathan's Space Report. What about the science that's come out of this enterprise, the Apollo missions and the other the whole moon program? How important has it been?
Well, I think there's been a lot of good science that came out of Apollo in the end. You have to understand that there are really two space programs. There's the scientific space program and the astronaut program, whose main purpose is to explore, to colonize, to eventually have that future where we are living on these other worlds. Science is secondary in the astronaut program, but we did discover some really important things. We discovered that the moon was originally ripped off from the Earth billions of years ago. It shares a common origin. We discovered a lot about the early history of the solar system when, in an era before the Earth's continents and oceans had settled down, when the sky was full of falling rocks from pieces of planets that hadn't yet joined up to make the big planets in the solar system. An enormous amount of understanding about not just the history of the moon, but the history of the Earth came out of Apollo.
Jonathan McDowell, again, astronomer at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Steven Weinberg is professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, winner of the Nobel Prize in physics and also the National Medal of Science, author of many books, including The First 3 Minutes, a book about the origins of the universe. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon.
We just heard Buzz Aldrin say in a very emotional way that we've got to go to Mars. If we don't, the Russians and the Chinese will get there before we do. They already have a program for going to Phobos, the moon of Mars. Is he right?
He's a terrific spokesman for the manned spaceflight program. But I think we have to look at it a little bit more coolly. If the public feels that to have Americans walking around on Mars is worth close to $1 trillion, and if having a Mars colony just for the sake of having people living on Mars is worth several $1 trillion, well, it's not the way I feel, but I don't have any special qualifications to judge that. But if you say that this can be defended because of the technological spin-offs, the things we'll learn about how to do technology, or through its scientific fruits, or because it will give America some kind of military advantage, well, I think that's just not true, and we should be honest about it.
Why isn't it true?
Well, because whatever can be done by people can be done more efficiently by unmanned expeditions at much less cost. And I think that's the kind of technology that's going to be of use here on Earth. What you learn by sending people into space is how to keep people alive in space. What you learn by sending robots to the surface of Mars or the moon is how to deal with problems in real time by computer programs, by robots. These are things that we need here on Earth. I think now technology has developed to the point where the kind of things that were done by the Apollo astronauts on the moon can be done by unmanned missions like the Spirit and Opportunity rovers on the moon, and at a cost which is less by a factor of about 1,000 per mission. And for the cost of having a few Americans once or twice go to Mars, we could have hundreds of rovers going all over the planet. Now, that won't be as thrilling, certainly. And if people want to spend $1 trillion for the thrill, well, who am I to say they shouldn't? But as far as scientific knowledge, no, that's not the way to gain it.
Buzz Aldrin talked about a permanent colony, or at least one that lasts for 5 years, I think, and talked about the spirit that is required to do that and the importance of leadership in this context. You're saying that whatever the benefits of that might be, it's just not worth it.
Well, I think Buzz Aldrin is right that there's no point in going back to the moon. And he also said in his interview that there's not much point in having Americans go to the Mars and come right back, maybe once or twice. Congress would soon cancel the program, as they did cancel the last two Apollo missions when it got boring to them. The problem of building a colony there is much greater. I mean, that's a cost that goes beyond anything that has been imagined. And you know, It doesn't make sense as an economically self-sustaining colony. You know, we don't have economically self-sustaining colonies in Antarctica, and compared to Mars, Antarctica is heaven.
Again, Steven Weinberg is a Nobel Prize winner and professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin. Back to Jonathan McDowell with Jonathan's Space Report at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Do you agree with that?
I agree with most of what Professor Weinberg says. He's absolutely right on the scientific side. And I think the question that's still open is whether or not that self-sustaining colony can make it, whether there can be a rationale for it. I think that the rationale for the human space program ultimately is only, can you make humans survive in a self-sustaining way off the Earth? And the motivations for doing that include, in the very long term, wanting civilization to be a little more robust against bad things happening on the Earth. The spirit of adventure, increased diversity in society you'd get by having not everything on the Earth. But all of those things are hard to argue that it's hard to argue that they're urgent. And I do think that the advantage of going back to the moon is that you could learn some of this self-sustaining technology in an environment where it's only 3 days to get back to the Earth if something goes wrong. So I think that's the advantage of going to the moon first. But I agree with Buzz that Mars is the obvious place to aim for and to plan for, although there's also asteroids that one could go to look for resources. So there's a number of options for the future human space program, and I think there's a big discussion going on right now about what direction it should really go.
When you talk about a self-sustaining colony off the Earth in the very long term, what do you mean by very long term? You're not talking about the end of this century.
No, I think for a colony to be fully self-sustaining, we're talking a couple of centuries probably. But that doesn't mean that you can't go a long way within our lifetimes with experiments that recycle materials. The very first tiny step is happening now on the space station when they, I understand they repaired the toilet today. So they're recycling materials on the space station so they don't have to bring so much up from Earth every month or so. And so I think that, the realization has happened that that was a problem on Apollo. We went, we came back, each time was as expensive as the previous one. Moving towards being self-sufficient, even in a little ways, will really help, I think.
Jonathan McDowell with Jonathan's Space Report. Back to Steven Weinberg at the University of Texas at Austin. Where are we now, and what is President Obama doing to try to determine what to do next?
Gee, I wish I knew. There is a panel headed by Norman Augustine. It has one or two astronauts on it. NASA has a new director, an ex-astronaut. I'm a little worried that the arguments for manned spaceflight may be prevailing, but it's too soon to tell. The astronomers are now doing their usual once every 10-year survey of what is needed for real science in space missions and on ground-based missions. And it remains to be seen what their priority list is going to be. I think one thing that's important to emphasize is that NASA has done a wonderful job in sending up satellites that do fundamental science, learning the age of the universe, learning things about what happened in the first few seconds of the history of the universe. This is all unmanned space science, and that has been crowded out in the last 5 years by the exorbitantly expensive manned spaceflight program. Part of my concern about this is my concern for real science, which is suffering because of the emphasis on manned spaceflight.
Jonathan McDowell, you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think that many of us in the science community have are actually quite thrilled by the astronaut program, but we get very unhappy when it's underfunded by Congress to the extent that it starts stealing from the unmanned science program. It's really important, I think, that and there is a lot of support in Congress for a robust unmanned science exploration program. I think there's also strong support for increasing the amount of money we do on robotic satellites to study the climate, to work on climate change issues. And so I think that we're going to see, I hope that we're going to see increased support for that. And then the nation has to decide whether it can also afford to have a properly funded human spaceflight program. The worst thing that you can do is to have an ambitious goal like going back to the moon and then underfunding it so that it falls further and further behind schedule while stealing money from the other very successful science programs that are going on. So I think that's the concern in the scientific community right now. And if the economy recovers a bit and the country can find a way to fund it all, so much the better.
Steven Weinberg, you said earlier that there's no applicable defense oriented accomplishment that was envisioned or that could be envisioned from going to the moon of Mars or to Mars itself. What about the unmanned program? Does that have national security implications?
Oh, yes. Well, it certainly does. I mean, unmanned satellites provide surveillance of the whole Earth. There is a GPS satellite program that allows the United States to discover when anyone launches a missile anywhere on the Earth and identify the source. We use satellites for communications over the horizon. We use satellites for all sorts of things that have military importance. These are all unmanned. Some of them are taken up into space by the space shuttle, but that was essentially a political decision to keep the space shuttle economically viable. Most of them are brought into space by unmanned rockets, and they all could be more cheaply.
Do you think that that given the proclivity of Congress for military spending, that it Congress might nonetheless underfund the science program if, in fact, it decides that it wants to put more money into the manned space program?
Well, I think there has been a kind of illusion that having Americans in space somehow protects our country. Tom Wolfe has written about this very amusingly, about how the American reaction when German Titov orbited the Earth, passing over the United States three times. People thought we were suddenly vulnerable to Russian cosmonauts, I should say. Well, that was nonsense. We're maybe vulnerable to Russian missiles, but they're not missiles that would be launched from space. That's not a sensible way of doing that sort of thing. Well, if you can use the word sensible in that context. I've said, and I haven't been contradicted on it, that there has been never a moment in the history of the space age when being able to put people into space gave any country the slightest military advantage.
Back to Jonathan McDowell, again, a historian of the space program with Jonathan's space report. Has NASA, do you think, sort of faded now, and has it, in terms of public approval and excitement, and you've both used the term thrill, has it sort of lost its stature?
Well, you know, I think that, I think Professor Weinberg will agree with this, that people are really excited still about the incredible pictures that come from the Hubble. The excitement of the Mars rovers going across the surface of the Red Planet. But in terms of the human space program, the shuttle and the space station never captured people's imagination as much as Apollo did. And you know, the American public's pretty bored with it, I think. And so the idea of going back to the moon and then going on to Mars is at least has the potential to re-engage the American public. It is a way of getting kids interested in science. You can probably do that cheaper otherwise. I think that NASA has consolidated a lot of expertise in human spaceflight over the past 40 years. They know a lot more about how to run humans in space. But if they really want to engage the public, they have to be doing something more exciting than they have been doing. I think that they are casting around for that right now. It'll be really interesting to see what the Augustine Commission decides. I think that it's unlikely that they'll recommend do away with the human spaceflight program. So, you know, the question is, what will they do with it, and will it really engage the public? And that'll be really interesting to see.
Professor Weinberg, a final question to you. At the moment, we're looking for planets that are more and more like Earth in other places, in other solar systems, presuming that if even Mars is hardly at least a foreseeable colony in the early at any time soon. What are the prospects for ever getting to those places? And if you can't get there, why do you want to know about them?
Oh, I want to know about them. I want to know whether there are places that life independently of our planet may have arisen. The Europeans, who don't put money into manned spaceflight, have just launched a mission called Herschel, going out 1 million miles from Earth, where it will examine distant stars for signs of planets, hoping perhaps to find planets like the Earth. I think this expands human knowledge, and it's very exciting whether or not we think we can go there. I think perhaps on the time scale of tens of thousands of years, we will be able to go there. But it's a little premature to plan that now.
In the meantime, Jonathan McDowell, do you think the Congress will be willing to come up with what the scientific part of the space program is going to require, or are you waiting pretty much for the Augustine Commission to come back and make some recommendations?
Well, I certainly think it's important that the Augustine Commission makes this report. As Steve mentioned, the Decadal Survey from Astronomy is going to set some astrophysics priorities. So I've no doubt that NASA will carry on doing really exciting science work. I will say also that this is an international effort. Despite what was just said, the Europeans do have a lot of money in human spaceflight as well, as do the Japanese. There's a Belgian just about to take command of the International Space Station. So I think, you know, another aspect of what's going on is that space exploration, both the unmanned and the manned, is becoming more and more international. And I think that's a huge improvement on the days of Apollo, where it was all about rivalry with the Russians. Now it's about learning to work with engineers and scientists from different cultures, and that part is very exciting.
We're going to leave it at that. Thank you both very much for being with us. Jonathan McDowell at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and author of Jonathan's Space Report. Steven Weinberg, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin, Nobel Prize winner and author of The First 3 Minutes, a book about the origins of the universe. And thanks to our earlier guest, Buzz Aldrin, who set foot on the moon 40 years ago today. Newspapers with big budgets are in big trouble, and that's raised concern about the future of investigative reporting. But decades ago, one dogged figure established a paradigm that has current relevance in the age of the Internet. We'll hear about I.F. Stone in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
Foreman Only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In the 1960s, I.F. Stone's Weekly was must-reading in Washington, a one-man operation that often scooped the Washington Post and the New York Times. The author and publisher had been a popular New York journalist during the Depression who was effectively blacklisted during the McCarthy era as an accused Russian spy. D.D. Cuttenplan is London correspondent of The Nation. He's author of a lengthy new biography, American Radical, The Life and Times of I.F. Stone. Don Guttenplan, welcome to our program.
Pleasure to be here, Warren.
How important was it that I.F. Stone was, as you describe him in your title, a radical?
Well, I think it's very important. I mean, part of the point of the book is to show what one reporter can accomplish. But the other part of it, in a way, is to suggest that if our national conversation excludes radicals, as it does from time to time, it did during the 1950s, and in a way you could argue it has done for the past 10, 15 years, then that whole national conversation is impoverished. It's interesting. I was listening to a discussion this afternoon on the radio. It's afternoon here on the East Coast, about assassination and the CIA's, you know, secret assassination plans and whether those were approved or not approved. And I was remembering what I.F. Stone wrote after John Kennedy was assassinated, when he pointed out that Americans had all lived with the idea of assassination as a policy tool, that the right tried to use it against Castro, and they'd used it against people in Africa, and also the left was happy when Diem was assassinated in Vietnam because Diem had been a dictator and unpopular, and Kennedy wanted him out of the way, and a lot of American liberals cheered when he was assassinated, and the CIA colluded in those assassinations. And what Kennedy, what Stone said is that it's not the ease in obtaining guns that leads to assassinations like the Kennedy assassination; it's the ease in obtaining excuses. He also said, and this was an incredibly shocking thing to write in November 1963, he wrote, "We all had a finger on that trigger," meaning that if we participate in a culture in which murder is an instrument of policy, then how can we be surprised when that blows back onto our own shores? Now, it seems to me that the discussion I heard on the radio today lacked that perspective about assassination. It was all about whether, well, of course it was okay to go to send the CIA out to kill bin Laden, and we should have been surprised if anybody did anything different, even though in the 70s, when we supposedly learned the lessons of the 1960s and our policy of assassination, it was made against the law. So I guess part of the reason I wrote this book is to remind people who may not have been alive at the time or may have forgotten the history, that history matters, and that it's important that Stone was a radical because he was able to stand, in a way, at a different angle to the national conversation, and that enabled him to see things that other people couldn't see.
There still are people who remember I.F. Stone as a guy who was not just accused of, but who they actually believe was a Russian spy.
Well, there aren't people who remember that. There are people who claim it. There are people who've been claiming it for a long time. But it's interesting. In the 1950s, when Stone launched I.F. Stone's Weekly, he was under daily FBI surveillance. So J. Edgar Hoover's agents were reading his mail. They were tapping his phone. They were even rifling through his garbage. In fact, I've read through transcripts of FBI reports where he took his son out for driving practice to get his driving license. And the agents were reporting on that. And you know what they found? They found that he was exactly what he pretended to be, which is an independent radical. The reason that the charges don't go away, though, is not because I.F. Stone actually was a Soviet spy. The actual evidence connecting him with the KGB is that he had a couple of conversations in 1936 with someone who he might or might have not known was a KGB agent. So the evidence is laughable. But the charges are important because they show that Stone still represents a threat to people. The idea is that if you are a radical journalist and you can be shown to be a tool of a foreign power, whether it's Moscow or Cuba or any other foreign power, it's easy to dismiss you. But if you're independent, if you say that it's not the right who are the patriots, but the left who are entitled to call themselves American patriots just as much as anybody else, if you say that your politics spring from American concerns and American soil, and you can't be dismissed, that's a threat to the status quo, and that's why Stone still represents a threat, even though he's been dead for 20 years.
He was fearful enough that he almost left the country and moved his family. He was worried about them, too, because of the surveillance and the hostility that he received to Israel.
I want to jump in slightly,
yeah, sure.
Warren, because he was not fearful of the surveillance. He never knew about the surveillance.
Excuse me.
Okay. What he was fearful of was not being allowed to travel, and indeed when he came back to the United States from France in 1951, they tried to take away his passport. It's a funny story, really, because a lot of people had their passports taken away. Many of them were no more than sort of middle-of-the-road liberals, but there was a person at the State Department who ran the passport office, and if she didn't like you, she could take your passport away. They came around to Stone's house, and they asked for his passport, and he said, "Why the hell should I give you my passport? I'm not just going to give it to you because you want it. You have to give me a reason for getting it." So they wrote him a letter pointing out that under the law you're obligated to point out to give back your passport if the government asks for it. And he said, "Well, I know you're entitled for it, but you still haven't given me a reason." And in the end, they never did get his passport. He didn't try to leave the country again. And in fact, the passport they had been coming for had expired 2 or 3 months before.
So very quickly, we've only got a month. We've only got a minute left, and sure. I want you to talk about what one reporter can accomplish, given the example of I.F. Stone.
Well, I mean, let's take the Gulf of Tonkin as a good example. In August 1964, when Lyndon Johnson said that the United States forces in the Gulf of Tonkin had been the victim of an unprovoked attack Every news organization in the country put his charges on the front page and believed them, except for IF Stone's Weekly, which pointed out that the only evidence of one of these attacks were a couple of bullet holes on the front end of a destroyer. And it turned out that Stone was absolutely right, that there had been no attack, that the whole thing had been fabricated in order to justify Johnson's escalation in Vietnam. But it took the Pentagon Papers in 1971 before the mainstream media caught up to him.
Okay, once again, an example of what can be done and an instructive example, one would think, given the fact that we're now going to have to depend on the Internet and people who aren't supported by big newspapers anymore.
Well, the one thing I would say is that Stone was very careful in his use of evidence because he wasn't interested in just preaching to the converted. He was interested in convincing people who didn't agree with his premises or his politics. And that's something that I think a lot of us who blog could learn from him. He used publicly available documents and publicly available sources. He often caught the Pentagon by using the Pentagon's own documents. So, you know, he was a very careful reader, but he never expected you to take anything on faith. And I think that would be the main thing that anybody who wants to follow in his footsteps should take away.
John Guttenplan, the American radical, the life and times of I.F. Stone. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Andrea Brody and Gary Scott. I'm Warman Olney. Thanks for joining us.
PRI, Public Radio International.